Tonight's talk is about sila. My preferred translation of that Pali word is virtue. Whenever the Buddha taught, the Buddha was a wanderer, right? Wherever he went, the first thing he always taught was dana and sila. This was like every time. And he taught it because he wanted to make sure that people understood sort of where he was coming from on, in the physical world. But I also think he taught it because no matter who was listening, everyone could practice dana and virtue. Dana and sila were like something that you didn't need any special qualifications. You didn't have to be in any physical shape. You didn't have to be able to walk. Who cares? As long you could, everyone, without exception, you didn't have to be a brilliant scholar. Didn't have to sit still and meditate. All you had to do was practice these things, which is why he taught them first, so that everyone felt included. And because a lot of the time he was speaking with householders, and that's all they could have time for anyway, because they were just trying to keep their cows happy and get in the crops sort of thing. And it was like they weren't going to have time to go and sit and meditate anyway. So, I want to talk tonight. I want to talk about sila, virtue, and I want to point out a couple of things. Number one, virtue is like a very sort of, I think, old-fashioned word. You don't hear a lot of talk about virtue anymore. It's often confused with morality, but morality is actually something quite different, I think. Think of virtue as intelligently following certain guidelines that will lead to a life conducive to practice. And morality is a set of rules you must follow. I mean, the Ten Commandments, all different traditions have various versions of this sort of thing. The difference is, and this is, I think, a very important difference, is morality is often like a wagging finger, like, do this. You must do this, or else. There's always an or else in those teachings. So morality almost always has a layer of fear involved. Do this, or you'll be shunned. You'll be thrown out of the community. You'll be banned. You'll burn in hell for eternity. I mean, there's always some level of that, and so if there, it's it was like enforced by fear. The idea behind all of those moral traditions and codes was that as human beings were born, literally born, not good. We're born as bad people, and we need these constraints to make us into good people. Virtue and the teachings on virtue are the opposite. The teachings on virtues really believe that everyone is inherently good, that everyone has, at some level, at some place in their heart, mind, this compass that leads towards goodness, wholesomeness. It's a very different outlook on human beings. And virtue is like, if virtue is more like just a finger that goes, go this way. Instead of, the finger doesn't wag, it just points. It says, this, go in this direction, and things will work out better. Try to live this way and see what happens. It's just a different angle on these questions of how we live a good life, good in the sense of wholesome. Very different ideas behind them. And The other thing is, and this is also quite important, I think, is that in many, many teachings, the Buddha, especially in a lot of the lists the Buddha had, he spoke of virtue as, well, do this first, practice this first, and then this will lead to these other things. And there's many examples of this. There's one here. This is from the Anguttara Nikaya. Guttara means the numbered. So this is for the numbered discourses, and this is a list of the 10 steps from virtue to enlightenment. But it starts with virtue. Virtuous ways of conduct have non-remorse as their benefit and reward. So you have, if you lead a virtuous life, you have non-remorse. You have the bliss of blamelessness, as the Buddha would call it. Non-remorse has gladness as its benefit and reward. Gladness has joy as its benefit and reward. Joy has its serenity as its benefit and reward. Isn't that interesting? Joy has serenity. This is like, the seven factors of awakening. We have pity, all that high energetic, and then comes calm and still. Same idea. Serenity has happiness as its benefit and reward. Happiness has meditative concentration as its benefit and reward. Meditative concentration has knowing and seeing things as they really are as its benefit and reward. Knowing and seeing things as they really are has non-attachment as its benefit and reward. Non-attachment has liberation as its benefit and reward. In this way, virtuous ways of conduct lead step by step to the highest. And this is just one example that I could, if we started just digging through the sutta, would find all kinds of examples of this. I mean, think about even like the Eightfold Path. We have, right understanding and right intention. Like we figure out we got to do something and we're heading in the right direction. And then what does the Buddha do? He teaches virtue, right speech, right action, right livelihood, before he says anything about meditative practice. Get your life together in this day-to-day world. That's what you have to do first. And here's another example. This is from the Majjhima Nikaya. And this is one of those places where some monk from another tradition has come and asked the Buddha, well, how do you train your monks? How do you train people? And this is the third verse in this sutta, Sutta 107, for anybody who keeps track of these things. It is possible, Brahman, to describe gradual training, gradual practice, and gradual progress in this Dhamma and discipline. Just as, Brahman, when a clever horse trainer obtains a fine thoroughbred colt, he first makes him get used to wearing the bit and afterward trains him further. So he once again he's using this example that everyone would understand, because people trained horses. I was like, people would understand this no matter who. So the Tathagata, when the Tathagata, that's the Buddha, obtains a person to be tamed. You go to the Buddha to be tamed. It's an interesting image, right? He first disciplines him thus: come, bhikkhu, be virtuous, restrained with the with be perfect in conduct and resort, and fearing, seeing fear in the slightest fault, train by undertaking the training precepts. Start with virtue, and then we can deal with all this other stuff afterwards. So, and this is like, as I'm saying, this is like a recurring theme. And he mentions there the training precepts. Well, as a monastic, there was, I don't know, 136 or some huge number of precepts, of training principles, right? But for householders, the best thing to do is to look at just the first five. The first five precepts are often taught, and because they apply equally well to householders and monastics. There are three more after that that sometimes will apply to householders on retreat, but the first five have meaning, have it, they're sort of like a definition of how to lead a virtuous life, the five precepts. And at the very start, I want to talk about these in the sense that we remember that these are things we practice. These are all practices. They're not like rules. They're not like you got to do this. This is like, well, figure out what this means to you, and then try and put this idea into practice. So the first five precepts: non-harming, taking only what is offered, not using wrong speech, refraining from sexual misconduct, and not abusing intoxicants. And we can look at each of these separately, but the interesting thing is they will also look at how they interact and meld and connect with each other quite clearly. They're not five separate things. It's sort of like five aspects of the same idea. These are the five aspects of virtue for a householder to pay attention to. Well, so non-harming, let's start with the obvious one, the first one. Obviously means not killing another living being. It's pretty straightforward, right? But it means, I think, a lot more than that. Basically, we need to look at all our actions of body and speech and see if they're causing harm to another being. Not necessarily killing them, just like, am I causing harm by what I'm doing? And this takes, now we have to think, wow, every time, everything I say anything or do anything, I have to have this in mind. It's a pretty big practice right there, right? And you can look at it from a lot of different ways. One way I think, I've come to think more and more about this, being involved with the Ekodharma Retreat Center and how they look at the world, and I've seen it the same way in some senses. And you can look at this from like an environmental point of view. Is what I'm doing harming the environment? Because in harming the environment, I am absolutely sure that I'm harming other beings. If I'm, emitting toxic fumes into the air, other beings are going to absorb those toxic fumes, guaranteed, and it's going to harm them. And so it's like that's, I mean, I don't think any of you go around deliberately emitting the toxic fumes, but it's like, what does this mean? Where's the line here? It also means, I think, as best we can, not consuming other beings. And that's a big one, because especially in our culture where that's like the opposite. I mean, I grew up Sunday dinner, roast beef and Yorkshire pud. I mean, that was like the main thing. And we have to start thinking, oh wait, can I shift? Maybe, and it took me, I'm telling you, it took me a long time to sort of shift from that cultural idea of what diet was to, as I am now vegan, it's a long road. And so you don't sort of like, all right, tomorrow I'm going to be vegan. It won't work. But if you want to sort of approach this and go step by step by step by step, it's a practice. And you practice by going a little further and a little further. Also, how our biases and prejudices affect others, especially with our speech, but also sometimes in how we act. We act unthinkingly and cause harm for others just in doing what we're doing. We think and we speak and act without realizing that these basic assumptions we have about how things are often quite delusional. I'll give you a personal example again, and this is quite personal, actually. I grew up in an extremely white world. Canadian armed services. I'm not joking here. I never even met someone who wasn't white until I was 14 or 15. And even then, it was like one person. It was just like, and so my understanding of what it was to be black was like based on what I saw on TV and read in the newspapers, and it was all like, oh, those black people, they're really dangerous. And to this day, I'm walking down the street and I see a black male person walking towards me. I have to like, I feel myself getting tight, and I think, well, maybe I should just cross the street to avoid this person. And I'm sure this person is used to white people just avoiding him in this way, and that's causing harm. And I have to be aware that that's causing harm, and really, really trying not to do that. And so, what we have to keep looking at everything we do in our lives, everything, all our habitual patterns and reactions, and go, is this causing harm? And then see if we can change those patterns. But first, by just being aware of them, of course. One last note here. On retreat, this has yet another meaning. And that's that we have to be extra mindful of the other people we're practicing with to make sure we keep that, the container, the practice container, especially the container of silence, really strong. If one person starts talking or starts sort of doing the wink, wink, nudge, nudge, eye contact stuff that goes on in retreats, it throws it off for everyone. Other people. It harms them in subtle and not so subtle ways. I can remember on one retreat I was on, I was just on my walk on one of the trails, just going for a walk, right, innocently. And this person came the other way. And of course, traditionally what you do is you'd not make any eye contact at all. But this person looked straight at me and made like really powerful eye contact before I realized what was going on and looked away. And I spent a good half a day on that retreat trying, what was that all about? Was this person trying to communicate something? It was like my mind spun out just because this person broke the container in that way. In daily life, it's less so. Even there, we have to think, how like my little example of how I react to when I see a young black man walking towards me. We have to think about that all the time. How do we act in ways that harm others? In often totally unintentional ways, just by acting out of habit. Okay. Becoming more and more aware of this particular precept and how it affects us, what it means to practice this more deeply, makes us more sort of connected to everyone else, and less, it lessens our sense of being separate, because we start to see everyone wants to feel safe. Everyone has the right to feel safe, and we start to experience that and feel that more. Okay. Taking only what is offered, then the second precept. Obviously, not stealing, right? Pretty clear there. But it's for a monastic, this meant because they the only how they ate is they'd go on rounds with their begging bowl, with their eyes downcast, walking through the village, and people would put food in their bowl, but they couldn't say, there was like monks with, oh, do you have any chilies to go with that rice? Take And said that was like very verboten, right? Should take only what is offered. Whatever's offered, that's what's okay. What does it mean? We're not wandering around with our begging bowl, right? What does this mean for us more? And I think this has a more, try not to take more than our fair share of what the world has to offer. Try not to sort of accumulate stuff just for the sense of accumulating stuff. Get more stuff. I always mention this. I had a student once who had this great t-shirt that said, "The person with the most toys when they die wins." And it's like that's the message of our culture. And we have to sort of go, "Oh wait, I don't need more stuff." I mean, we need stuff. We all have to have stuff. You need a computer to do what we're doing right now. Without a computer, we quit. So yeah, we need some stuff just to function in the world as it is today. And so that's fine. I'm not saying you shouldn't have any stuff. But we should have to really think about how much stuff do I have and do I really need this, or can I give some of this stuff away to other people who need it? Because it's always people who need things. If we have something that's a good thing that we don't need anymore, and we give it to, some charitable organization that distributes things to people or sells things to people really cheaply, it's always going to go be of use to other people. And the other part of this is there's this cultural message of that we deserve to have all this stuff. It's like, if we have lots of stuff, it must mean we were really good. That's the message we keep hearing over and over and over again. The prosperity doctrines of certain Christian organizations these days, that's exactly what they're saying. And we have to be aware of that constant chatter in our culture about how people who have all this stuff are good people. Because often people who have a lot of stuff may not be so good. Leave it at that. The third of these, right speech. For the Buddha, this was a huge topic. The Buddha kept coming back to this. I mean, there it is in the Eightfold Path. As soon as he starts talking about how to live in the world, the first thing he says is right speech. And it's because it's through speech that we cause the most harm. I mean, if we're not sort of inclined towards going around whacking people with sticks, which some people are, which causes a lot of harm, obviously. But if that's not just how we speak can be often quite harmful. Often once again, without being aware. And so this is why this is such a good thing to practice. There's this teaching called the 10 unwholesome acts of body, speech, and mind. Of those 10, four are about speech, more than the other two, which I think is really interesting. I mean, when the Buddha that hearing, think of all the acts of body that might be bad or acts of mind, speech becomes the big issue here. And it's like, so how does the Buddha talk about speech? He talks about it. Let's talk about it in a class. Here's one classic list also. I'll come to another classic list in a minute. But it's basically not telling lies, being truthful. Don't speak harshly. Don't gossip. And don't engage in useless talk. I love that category, useless talk. Well, the first one, not lying, it's pretty obvious, right? But even here, it's like, well, I'll never lie, right? That becomes like, I'm so virtuous, I'll never lie. But the truth is, there might be times when the virtuous thing to do might be to tell a total untruth. You know, we're sitting all together in our physical room instead of a Zoom room. Someone comes in and says, and he's, the someone who comes in is holding a gun in his hand, right? And he says, "Is Carl here?" I'll tell you, I'm going to say, "Carl? Carl who? There's no Carl here." I'm going to lie through my teeth because that's the virtuous thing to do in that particular situation. So it's like, it's not, I'm like, I'm saying these aren't hard and fast rules. We have to always think about them and how they apply in our lives and in the situation we're in. We can't just follow the rules. We have to be aware and practice. But in general, not lying is probably a good idea. Harsh speech, however, this is one I've had to really work with because I had that tendency in my life to sort of, when things weren't going my way, I would, because I'm a big guy with, and my father was a drill sergeant, right? So I have the sort of drill sergeant voice. If I wanted, I can sort of bark. You know, rawr, and sort of force people to pay attention always caused harm, always made someone else uncomfortable and unhappy. It just, that's the nature of harsh speech. Harsh speech always puts someone else in a place of fear or unhappiness or whatever. Just guaranteed that's what's going to happen. I used to catch myself doing this when I would be on the phone talking to some service person thing and explaining some situation about, you know, my computer isn't working anymore because blah blah blah, whatever it was. And if I wasn't getting what I wanted, what I thought I deserved, right? I deserve to be treated with respect, and you know, I'm a paying customer, and blah blah blah. I would start to bark, and I'd say, "I want to speak to the manager," you know, blah, 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 you know. And I'd always, you know, and I'd try and couch it in, "Well, you know, I don't think that you're, I'm not saying you're not doing your job well, but mine, obviously what I'm asking for is too important for you to deal with. So you should take me up a couple of levels in the." What nonsense. It was just being harsh and masking it underneath this sort of sweet blah, 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 right? And I'm not saying, once again, that sometimes that's what you have to do to take care of something, that you need to speak to someone up at a higher level of the organization. But there's ways to do that, that very carefully, that don't cause harm, and we have to learn not to just bark and barge our way in a sense. Gossip. Gossip is seductive. Gossip is always, "Well, you know, I know this thing about so and so, and I'm gonna just tell you, but don't tell anybody," right? That's the mode of gossip. Well, you're harming the person you're gossiping about, for sure. You're also harming the person you're gossiping to because you're filling their mind with the delusional crap half the time anyway. And you're harming yourself because now you're sort of going, "See how important I am? I know something other people don't know, but I'm going to share it with you because I'm such a nice guy. Aren't I wonderful?" That's where that gossip always goes, in that making yourself look important energy. Always harmful. And on all three levels, for yourself, for the person you're gossiping or people you're gossiping to, and the person you're gossiping about. And often what you're saying has no basis in fact anyway, which is another layer of truth that you have to deal with. And then you come to the last one on this list, which is useless talk. And this, I like this for two reasons. One is, it's like the Buddha saying, "Well, you know, even if, you know, it's not the, these other three, There's a lot of stuff you do that's just useless. Why bother doing it? Why blather? And often useless talk has to do with us feeling uncomfortable. We're in a social situation, and it's like, oh, I can't just sit here and not say anything. I'm not, everybody else is saying I have to say something. And you'll say something like sometimes it's a total non sequitur, sometimes it's, totally useless. It's just blah 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 to sort of, and sometimes it's more almost aggressive in the sense of, well, I got to get my axe in. It's got to get my turn in this conversation. So I have to say this brilliant thing, and everybody. But it's just useless talk. It's really interesting sometimes just to try and say, is this really useful that I'm about to say? Is this actually useful, or is this just me wanting to get some attention? Which is often what useless talk has as the root. I want my turn. I want attention. But it doesn't serve any purpose at all. It's just, oh, you're wasting energy you could be putting into practicing. So that's one view of this right speech thing. There is another list, as I mentioned. This is I'm taking this out of Joseph Goldstein's book, but it's a quote from someplace in the sutta. I have yet to figure out exactly where. Bhikkhus, possessing five factors, speech is well spoken, not badly spoken. It is blameless and beyond reproach by the wise. What five? It is spoken at the proper time. What is said is true. It is spoken gently. What is said is beneficial. It is spoken with a mind of loving kindness. So this is instead of the knots, this is like putting everything into positive form. But it's interesting that there's two here that are not quite so deeply spoken of. When spoken with a mind of loving kindness, can I speak from a place in my heart full of loving kindness for those I'm speaking to? That's one of the criteria I have to meet when I'm speaking, that I'm speaking from a place of loving kindness. But the other one I think is also interesting, is it spoken at the proper time? And this is where we get caught thinking, well, this needs to be said. This person needs to know this. It's true. And I should tell them. But often it's absolutely not the proper time. And it's also sometimes not going to be beneficial. It might make you feel good and important that you know this thing and you're going to tell this person and set them straight. But is that really beneficial? Is that really spoken gently and from a place of loving kindness? This is where we often get lost in speech, speaking not at the right time. And often also we tune into someone and we see that they're really upset, but it's like we once again we feel like we got to say something. And maybe what we got to do is just shut our mouths and give them a hug, hold their hand, do anything but say anything to them, because they're not going to be open to what you're going to say anyway. But it's like, oh no, I should say this. It's not the right time. Save that for when they're going to be open to hearing you. Hard to do again because it's like it's that impulse to be the wise person in the room. So whether you either of these two lists are, I think, are good places to start. I have a sentence here. Much of the trouble in today's world arises from harmful speech. Think about our current politics, for instance. It takes great discipline to not rant angrily about certain politicians or religious leaders or whatever our favorite object of scorn is today. Right? It's just We rant. Even if it's internal in our minds rant, it's still speech in a sense. It doesn't do any good. Just harms ourselves. And it's the opposite of having a heart full of loving kindness towards this person. It's hard, this one, because it's so deeply ingrained, especially in our current culture. It's just so full of that sort of energy to not sort of want to jump in. Okay. Refraining from sexual misconduct. This is an interesting one, actually. What does it mean? I mean, obviously in the terms of he was speaking to monastics, it meant refrain. End of discussion. It was like a pretty simple rule for monastics. And we're householders. We live in the world. What does this mean in our sort of complex modern world? But if you look at the other precepts, this is where you start to really see how these all fit together. The other precepts make this clear. We shouldn't ever engage in any sexual action that harms another person. Cause no harm. Well, I mean, what does that mean? Well, that's now we have to think about that in the situations we're in. We shouldn't take what isn't offered. Well, that's pretty obvious, right? We shouldn't use any force. We shouldn't do anything that we have to lie about. Well, we can do this, but don't tell my X, Y, Z. Don't tell anybody. I don't want anybody to know about this, but, you know, let's have some fun. You know, that vibe, right? If it can't be spoken out about in the world, this is sexual misconduct. It's like I'm restricting something quite. I shouldn't gossip about it afterwards. I was a regular teenage guy, right? I know guys. I'm assuming I don't know because I was never a young teenage woman. But I suspect teenage women gossip too, just as much as the guys did. I know the guys did for sure. You know, boasted and blah blah blah. You know, I don't want to go into the gory details, but you know what I'm talking about. And finally, the last one we haven't got to yet, is not abusing intoxicants. We shouldn't behave in a sexual way if we're intoxicated, or if the other person's intoxicated. Intoxicated could be alcohol, it could be drugs of various sorts. Because we know that our judgment is clouded. That intoxicants cloud our judgment, and the potential for harm is greater, much greater. So we have to be very aware of that. Right? But notice what in this list I've been talking about, there's no cultural morality involved here. You know, it's all about the other people involved. How they will be affected by our actions. That's how we learn to look at refraining from sexual misconduct. Is this in some way affecting someone else in a way that isn't good? Ah, time to refrain. It sounds simple, but obviously it has all kinds of, you know, complicated things, because we're so good at talking ourselves, and, well, this is really okay. No one's going to know. Or you know, pick your things and see how you. It's so difficult, this one, because it's so bound up in our emotions as well. Wanting something. But I think it's really important that, like I said, there's no sort of wagging fingers here. This is all about thinking about things and doing acting in appropriate ways given the situation, so that there's no harm to anyone else. So there's nothing here about only between a man and a woman, for instance. There's nothing about any of those things that, in traditional moral teachings, you see the wagging finger come out in big time, full time. It just doesn't exist in the Buddhist teachings. Does not exist those moral laws about sexuality. Just not there. Which, and I've looked a lot to see what was there, and there's just nothing. It just doesn't come up. And there are, lots of extreme examples of people doing the opposite in the world today. I don't need to go into the details because, what recently happened in Gaza was a prime example. Quite obviously, people being abducted, women being abducted by men for sexual pleasure or sexual power or whatever they want to call it. It's wrong. Just and we have to be careful to think, well, that's what happens over there in Gaza or in one of those other countries that are pretty wild. Happens right here in Colorado all the time. I have a friend who's a police officer who is on the anti-slavery squad in Denver, and there's a sexual slavery issues in Denver all the time. He's always going out and raiding someplace and finding women who've been enslaved, literally. It's just, this is part of a sad part of the cultural world that we live in, but it's something to be aware of, I guess. Then there's not abusing intoxicants. And this is an interesting one for me, personally, because the actual teaching says don't abuse intoxicants. Period. And actually, the teaching really says just don't use intoxicants of any sort. Well, the truth is, I like a beer with some spicy food once in a while, or a glass of wine. So for me to say, don't you use any of those things, they're bad, you know. Also, who am I to talk? I was stoned for 2 years when I was younger. Literally, I was I was a hippie, right? What can I say? So I can't wag fingers here at all. But for me, the stoner part, that's gone. Like, that's 40 years since I've done any of that stuff. But I still, I like I say, once in a while, I like a beer or sometimes a glass of wine with a meal. Depends on what we're eating and the situation. But for me, how I draw the line in the sense about abuse is, one, I will have a beer or a glass of wine. That's it. No matter what the situation, that's the raw, for me, that's my place I am of understanding. Because if I have two, I haven't done it in a long time. Last time I did it, I just get stupid. What can I say? You lose that clarity of mind. And so for me, that's what works. So I don't abuse intoxicants, but I do enjoy them once in a while in very small quantities. And not very often. Maybe once a week, sometimes longer period between one time and the next. And that's plenty. And it's just, once again, everybody has to work this out for themselves. For some people, like I have friends who are teachers who are like, oh, no way, I just don't use it at all. Period. End of discussion. And other people lean even more the other way than I do. Well, it's okay if it's a social situation sort of understanding. Everybody's got their own. This is, and so I guess I'm just coming back to this idea that all of these things are practices. We have to look at them, think about them, figure out how they apply for us. And the other thing about intoxicants, and you know, I'm a volunteer chaplain at the hospital. Say 30, 40% of the people who are in a hospital are there because they've abused themselves with usually with intoxicants, but also sometimes just by massively overeating. You know, food can become a drug for some people. And this causes all kinds of harm to them, to their loved ones, to the culture as a whole, because the, you know, often these people also have no resources, so they have to, but we have to take care of them. It's the duty of the culture as a whole. They're taken care of, but what harm these things can cause? And often it's out of abusing these intoxicants, you get violence, lack of control of speech, misjudgment around sexuality, simply because people are intoxicated. Sad, but true. So let me try and summarize here. And I'm going to point out that there's a danger in this idea of virtuous conduct. It's hard to, after all I've said about making it sound so wonderful, how can there be a danger here? And the danger is because it's not hard, fast rules, it's, if we're not careful, we can delude ourselves and go, oh, that's okay. It's okay this time, or it's okay in general, or you know, however you want to think about it. But it's, and we go there because we really want to do something. I really want to X, Y, Z, whatever it is. And that desire, that wanting, overwhelms our sense of what is correct. Whereas with strict moral guidelines, thou shalt do this, thou shalt not do that. You just follow the rules, right? It's still not easy, but it's like this clear lines, very clear lines that you follow. But if you're practicing trying to be virtuous, you're always in the situation of, is this okay? Is this virtuous? Where's the non-virtue here? You have to, you're continually, all the time, practicing. This is an all the time in the world practice. So it's more difficult to be virtuous, interestingly enough. It's more difficult to be virtuous than to just follow the rules because it takes effort. And that's one thing I want to point out. The other thing I want to point out is much, perhaps even most of the trouble in the world today has arisen because people, both individuals and groups, have chosen not to be virtuous. Have actively chosen to not be virtuous. You look at all the stuff that's going on in the world that's harmful. It all comes down to a lack of virtue. That's a pretty simple summary of all the horrible things going on in the world. People aren't acting in a virtuous way. They may be acting in a moral way from their point of view, based on what their holy book says is okay, but they're not being virtuous. So being virtuous is more difficult than being moral. But it's the underpinning of all meditative practice. If you, I mean, I mentioned that phrase, the bliss of blamelessness, but if you actually live from the angle of virtue being a really important aspect of your life, it's much less likely that you're going to be caught in the mental turmoil of, oh, I wish I hadn't done that. Oh, nobody finds out. You know, all those things that happen when we don't act virtuously, and then we realize, we wake up in a sense, and now our mind's in turmoil, sometimes for ages. Sometimes for the rest of your life, your mind will be in turmoil about something. I met this man, this is my housemate, who was, after 32 years, was still, his whole life was absorbed in this thing he'd done 32 years ago, and how it hadn't been a good thing to do, and it hurt people, and it just consumed his mind. Literally consumed his mind to the point where it made him ill, physically ill. Part of the reason he was in the hospital. So, the bliss of blamelessness, leading a life of virtue, besides the fact that it feels good and it actually makes you happy, which is also a nice thing, it actually makes it easier for you to practice the meditative practices. The mind naturally stays calmer and stiller at the beginning of the practice, and you were not caught in the whirling mind of, oh my God, what about this and what about that? Here's just a few phrases I wrote down at the end. Non-harming leads to compassion. If we consciously are trying to not harm others, other beings, we become more compassionate towards other beings. It's just a natural result. Taking only what is offered leads to generosity. Oh, I don't need this. Let's give it away. It just naturally leads to generosity. Right speech leads to truthfulness. If you've ever been around someone who's always truthful, it's such a relief. It's so easy to be around someone who's always truthful, because you don't get caught in the wondering part of relationships with other people. Refraining from sexual misconduct leads to loving kindness for all beings. That's an interesting thought. Refraining from sexual misconduct leads towards loving kindness for all beings. And not abusing intoxicants obviously leads to clarity of mind. So it seems like practicing virtue leads to some pretty wholesome traits that we all would enjoy. That's a simple way to sum it up in some sense. One last thing. It's easy, if you're not careful, to go to the place of, oh, I'm supposed to be perfect. This isn't about being perfect at all. It's about slowly moving towards being perfect, but understanding that we're human beings, and sure enough, we're going to say and do, act in certain ways at certain times out of habit or out of desire or out of what? Anger, that are going to be unwholesome, that are going to be lacking in virtue. We have to understand that we're not perfect. And we're working towards being. So when something like that happens and we reflect on it, we go, oh, I have to be really careful not to do that again. I have to be very careful not to act in that way again or speak in that way again. We have to change. So we can, through reflection, we start to shift our patterns of how we react in certain situations. And at the same time, understand that we're not perfect and that we're not trying to be perfect. We're trying to move in that direction. Which takes me, of course, to a piece of poetry. It's Dana Fald's book, Go In and In. And this is a poem that sort of speaks to that idea of, that we're moving towards perfection. We don't have to be perfect. There's no have to here. It's called Walk Slowly. It only takes a reminder to breathe, a moment to be still, and just like that, something in me settles, softens, makes space for imperfection. The harsh voice of judgment drops to a whisper, and I remember again that life isn't a relay race, that we will all cross the finish line, that waking up to life is what we really were born for. As many times as I forget, catch myself charging forward without even knowing where I'm going, that many times I can make the choice to stop, to breathe, to be, and walk slowly into the mystery. And that's all we can do. Just walk slowly into the mystery. Practice is mysterious. And this affects her equally mysterious sometimes, I think.